In July, the Soho Forum hosted a three-way debate asking the question, who should libertarians vote for? George Mason University law professor Ilya Sommin made the case for Joe Biden. Chair of the Libertarian Party of Los Angeles, Angela McArdle, argued for Joe Jorgensen, and Manhattan contrarian blogger Francis Menton defended Donald Trump. A lot has changed since July, and with the election less than 3 weeks away, the Soho Forum hosted another event in which those same three libertarians updated their arguments for their preferred candidates. None of the debaters have changed their mind on who to vote for, but they all agree on one thing. The stakes have only gotten higher.
Hi, I'm Gene Epstein, moderator and director of the Soho Forum. We had a debate on who libertarians should vote for. On July 22nd, we had a libertarian favoring Biden, a libertarian favoring Joe Jorgensen, and a libertarian favoring Donald Trump. That debate got nearly 45,000 YouTube views so far, and still counting, by far our most popular online debate. So we thought that since time has elapsed, since July 22nd, we would revisit the issue by asking each of our debaters to deliver a short talk on why they still favor their candidate. We asked them basically to address two questions: what new arguments would you make to counter objections to your candidate? What new arguments would you make in support of your candidate? So you're about to hear each of them address those two questions, and to elaborate on whatever else comes to mind.
Thanks to the Soho Forum and to Gene Epstein to give me this opportunity for to update what I said a couple months ago in the debate about the presidential election. I really appreciate the opportunity, but actually I have only a few things to add to what I said then. If you recall, back then, the reason why I said Biden was a lesser evil than Trump from a libertarian perspective is primarily because of several big issues. He's better on immigration, he's better on trade, he's better on property rights, and even though he may not want to be, he's also better on government spending, not because he's wonderful in and of himself on that point, but because when there's a Democratic president in the White House, Republicans and even some Democratic moderates tend to favor spending restraint much more than they do when there's a Republican in the White House, as witness the fact that we had record deficits under Trump even before the coronavirus crisis hit. However, in the intervening couple of months, Donald Trump has taken the trouble and the time to add to my case in a couple of respects. First, Donald Trump has gone into an all-out embrace of NIMBYism. That is on restrictions on the use of property rights to build new housing. He now has clearly endorsed using zoning to do that. This is one of the biggest restrictions on property rights in any aspect of U.S. and or local or state government policy. It literally keeps millions of people from moving to places where they might have greater opportunity of various kinds, and it's also very damaging to the economy. And Trump has come full square in favor of this, as he and his his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, wrote all about it in a Wall Street Journal op-ed. He says that we have to exclude people so it won't destroy the suburbs. And with thinly veiled racial appeals, he implied that if you don't do this, maybe African Americans and Hispanics would move into majority white neighborhoods. So he's both undermining property rights and appealing to racial and ethnic bigotry simultaneously. It's not easy to get more unlibertarian than that. The Democratic Party is far from perfect on zoning issues. They have their own very troubling history with it. However, in recent years, Democrats have actually spearheaded reforms of zoning in places like California, Minneapolis, and elsewhere. Indeed, Trump even denounced the leading zoning reformers in California for the grave sin of trying to change California law to allow the building of multifamily housing in places where it's previously forbidden. So that's one issue where the contrast has gotten even greater and Trump has gotten even worse than before. The second is the nationwide eviction moratorium that Trump, through his Center for Disease Control, imposed just a few weeks ago, which essentially bans a large swath of landlords from evicting their tenants for virtually any reason until at least the end of the year, but quite possibly it'll end up being longer than that. The excuse for this is the coronavirus crisis, but this is being imposed regardless of how much the threat of transmission really is in a given area, and it is far from clear that this will even reduce transmission at all. Moreover, the way that this is structured, if you buy that the administration has the authority to do this, then you would also have to buy the idea that the same statute and the same regulations give it the authority to shut down any kind of economic transaction, or indeed even a non-economic transaction of any kind, so long as there is even some chance that allowing the transaction to go forward would allow any contagious disease of any kind to spread. It doesn't even have to be the coronavirus. It could be the flu or the common cold. The interpretation of the statute that enables them to do this would also enable Trump, with the help of the CDC, to mandate pretty much anything of any kind, or to shut down any transaction of any kind. It seemed to me that a presidential power grab this great is something not only libertarians, but anybody who believes in any kind of limited government should have reason to oppose. So that's another way in which he has reinforced my case. I should also mention that he has further reinforced it by, over the last few weeks, he has very visibly refused to denounce violence by people who support him, various right-wing militias, the Proud Boys, and others. By contrast, Biden, despite his flaws, has been more than willing to denounce violence by left-wing rioters and left-wing and far-leftists and others. I think that's a very important contrast. A political leader who is willing to openly praise, in some cases, violent supporters of his and endorse violence as a tool of politics, that's not something we want to have in a liberal democratic society. Finally, a word about Joe Jorgensen. I continue to believe, as I said in the original forum, that on most policy issues, she's better than either Trump or Biden. But I also continue to believe that she has virtually no chance of winning. Even in her most favorable polls, she does not rise above about 2%. And I think that's highly unlikely to change between now and November 3rd. So I think the bottom line is that Biden is significantly superior to Trump on a whole range of issues. I think there's no reason to change the conclusion that I reached about that a couple months. Biden is by no means perfect. If he becomes president, he will do many things that I disapprove of, and certainly probably other libertarians as well. But on the whole, he would be significantly better than Trump. And that's reason enough to prefer his victory over that of the incumbent. I'd like to say a brief word about the situation with the vacancy on the Supreme Court. I think Amy Coney Barrett, whom Trump has nominated, is a pretty good nominee in some respects. On the other hand, it's very noticeable that her selection caters much more to social conservatives than to libertarians. It's also notable that what Trump is doing here is he has helped create a crisis through making this appointment before the election. That crisis is a violation of the principle that the Republicans themselves endorsed in the 2016 election, which is that when a vacancy comes open in election year, the people, quote unquote, are supposed to decide. It could also lead to a court packing attempt on the part of the Democrats, which I admit is a real risk of a Biden victory. However, pushing court packing through will not be easy for Biden, as it would require him to get the support of virtually every single one of the Democratic senators that might be elected, assuming they have a majority at all. It's possible that at least initially, Biden would much prefer to pursue other objectives rather than spend a lot of political capital on this. So I think there is a risk here. It's real. I've written about it. But it doesn't outweigh the much larger and much more certain risk that would be created by reelecting Trump. Thank you.
I know that a lot of people have been concerned over Joe Jorgensen's social media right before our last Reason interview debate regarding who we should vote for president as libertarians. A lot of libertarians were upset and thought that she was pandering to Marxists because she had made comments in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that she did a pretty good job dispelling those concerns and saying that she was really just in solidarity with people who were concerned about police officers and the criminal justice system. harming Black people disproportionately, and quite frankly, harming anyone at all when they don't have to. And I think she's done a pretty good job of setting those fears at ease, at least for people who are interested in taking her seriously. And I know that she's had some other social media gaffes too. I would attribute that not just to her, but to her campaign and campaign staff, and how challenging it is to run a presidential campaign on a shoestring budget. So I think that those concerns are valid, but I don't think that they hold really any weight compared to some of the other issues that we've seen with the other two presidential campaigns, like Biden's refusal to address the 94 crime bill, Trump's continuous gaffes regarding his firearms position, his Second Amendment position. He just doesn't address any of those concerns. The fact that he really can't do anything for us when we live in a blue state and we're being controlled by tyrannical governors regarding the lockdown. Unfortunately, our government system just, it's not set up that way. The president isn't a dictator and he can't help us out. And so what can we do? Really nothing, I guess. Our president can't really save us. And at least Joe Jorgensen has addressed the fact that we do need our freedoms back, and I appreciate that. Obviously, everybody was also really upset with her Supreme Court suggestion for Alan Dershowitz, who was an attorney who defended Epstein in a case. That was pretty much terrible. It seemed to me that her campaign staff didn't do a very good job of researching those guys. However, she did issue a retraction of that, which I appreciate, which shows that she would actually listen to her constituency, unlike some of the other guys up there. We know that Biden he just basically ignores any criticisms that we give to him, and Trump's fan base doesn't really seem to acknowledge any of his wrongdoings or political missteps. So I guess it's no surprise that he wouldn't admit that anything he's doing is wrong. Overall, I think the Jorgensen campaign is really doing much better than the political circus that we've seen over the last week regarding Donald and Joe Biden, especially since that disastrous debate. I do think that it's still important to vote for to not vote for evil in this upcoming presidential campaign. I've stated a lot of reasons previously that I don't think that Donald Trump is going to quote unquote save us from socialism, and I don't think he's going to save us from authoritarianism either. And I think that if you look at the interplay between the left and the right now, what we're seeing is riots and civil unrest, mostly fomented by the left. And we're seeing a tyrannical reaction from the right. I think it's very possible that a Donald Trump re-election, is going to usher in a stronger wave of authoritarianism. And that'll be coming from the right. So I don't know that he's really the lesser of two evils. It seems like this sort of like sick political circus where no matter which one you go for, we're going to get authoritarianism. We're going to have, if we don't have coronavirus lockdowns, we're going to have anti-civil unrest, own the libs lockdowns that keep everyone under the boot of government. I will reaffirm my support of her because she hasn't done anything terrible. The worst things that she's done would be that she made the recommendation for Alan Dershowitz and then she retracted it. She's made a couple of other kind of dumb tweets. I don't even attribute that to her personally. I attribute that to her campaign. She's continued to stick with libertarian principles. She hasn't shifted the goalposts on any of her serious points. She's just continuing to preach free markets and economics and civil liberties. And I think that that's really important right now, especially economic policy. I know Donald Trump is really talking about how he's done as much for the economy as he can. But when we look at the state of things, I don't think so. I don't know that we should necessarily blame him personally for all of the gaffes of his administration and for how things could have been handled better in the beginning of the coronavirus epidemic. But I think that it is really systemic to big government. And right now, the Republican Party and its populism, it does preach big government. And Joe Jorgensen does not. She preaches limited government. She wants to get rid of the IRS. She wants us to have as much freedom as we can in healthcare as possible. And I think she's also very realistic about what she can do with executive authority. And I really appreciate that about her.
Thank you to the Soho Forum for having me today. I'm going to be updating my prior presentation from the debate we held on July 22nd. In the prior debate, I addressed substantially why I thought Joe Jorgensen was not really a viable candidate for president for a libertarian to vote for, so I'm not going to go into that again today. And I'm principally going to direct my attention to the question of Biden v. Trump, to issues that have arisen since July 22 on that subject. On the question of Biden v. Trump, I think there are two overriding things that libertarians should be concerned about and that should guide their vote. One is the Supreme Court. The other is the overall size and scope of government and where that is likely to go under the leadership of these two candidates as president. I'm going to start with the Supreme Court. So since our July 22 debate, as we all know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Trump nominated Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. In response to that, many Democrats have come out and said what the Democrats ought to do if Amy Coney Barrett gets confirmed, which is likely to happen, is they ought to pack the Supreme Court, that is, add additional Supreme Court justices, maybe three, maybe five, they haven't specified how many, to cement a liberal majority for the long term. And as those who follow the court know, the liberals tend to vote absolutely as a bloc on any issue of importance to their side politically. The conservatives, for whatever reason, tend not to. They often have one or two who do not vote with the bloc, but the liberals often vote as a bloc. And I want to go over two Supreme Court cases that illustrate why it is important not to have a liberal controlling voting bloc. One is Citizens United. That is the case that held under the Constitution, despite a statute that said the opposite, a conservative group could put out a movie critical of Hillary Clinton and show it during the presidential campaign. The four liberal justices are not the same four as they are today, but the four liberal justices voted as a bloc in dissent and basically came out for the proposition, which is what the statute provided for, that the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the liberal media, Hollywood, and all their allies can spend whatever they want in infinite amounts to support their side, while a conservative or libertarian candidate cannot, through a corporate entity, put out a movie within 60 days prior to the election. That is an example of the extremes to which the liberal bloc will go to silence conservatives and libertarians. Another Supreme Court case that I want to make sure you're aware of is the recent case involving the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Kagan wrote a dissent, Justice Kagan, joined by the other three liberals. And you ought to read that if you haven't seen it. It basically takes the point of view that Congress can create permanent bureaucracies outside of control of the president, staffed by experts who cannot be changed. You can vote for a new president. You cannot vote these people out. And with the liberal bloc, that is perfectly okay. Okay, now at the debate, Biden was asked the question, will you pack the court? And he gave the most incomprehensible answer ever heard. I'll read a little bit of it. Whatever position I take on that, that'll become the issue. The issue is the American people should speak. He goes on from there. He didn't answer the question. Trump jumped in. Are you going to pack the court? Biden, vote now. Trump, are you going to pack the court? Biden, make sure you in fact let people know you're senator. And on from there. He ultimately said, I'm not going to answer the question. If you care about the court, you know at this point that Biden is planning to pack the court if he can get enough votes in the Senate to do that. Okay, let me move on to the size and scope of the government. This is a fundamental issue for libertarians. Every dollar the government takes and every dollar the government spends is a government that private individuals and the private economy do not have to act in freedom as libertarians think they should be able to do. Now, Donald Trump is not exactly a small government guy. I have many criticisms of him. But by comparison to Biden, it is wildly ridiculous. Biden proposes spending, there are various estimates, $3 trillion a year, $4 trillion a year of new spending on everything and anything you can think of in the progressive wish list, the biggest item being so-called green energy, like as if the federal government has no limits and can solve every human problem with more and more and yet more government spending. Many of Biden's spending plans, they're not quantified particularly, but many of them are at least mentioned and described in such a way, as you can see how crazy they are, in something called called by everybody the manifesto. I think it's called the Biden-Sanders Unity Platform or something like that officially, but everybody calls it the manifesto. In the debate, and this is a question, of course, Chris Wallace didn't even ask, in the presidential debate, Trump said, listen, you agreed with Bernie and the manifesto. And Biden says, there is no manifesto. He actually said that in the debate. There is a 118-page document on Biden's website, which everybody refers to as the manifesto, and it has the craziest and the crazier and on and on and on of hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of programs that they are planning to expand the federal government with. I'll just read you a little bit of it. We will mobilize historic, transformative public and private investments to launch a clean energy revolution. We will use federal resources and authorities across all agencies to accelerate development of clean energy economy and deploy proven clean energy solutions. Create millions of family-supporting and union jobs. Upgrade and make resilient our energy, wastewater, transportation infrastructure, develop manufacturing. It goes on and on and on and on. Also in the debate, again, a question from Trump, not Wallace, who wouldn't ask any important question to Biden. Trump asked him, do you support the Green New Deal? And he says, no. Well, this thing is on his website. It's 118 pages. And who wrote the section on the climate? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and John Kerry are the co-chairs of that piece. Some estimate the Green New Deal is $80 to $100 trillion worth of spending. They have no sense of limits, no sense of limitation on the government. And if the government does this, there's nothing left of the private economy. I want to briefly mention energy and fracking. Fracking is what has driven the price of oil to half of what it was. Fracking is what has put all the bad actors like Russia and Iran and Venezuela essentially out of business and transformed our foreign policy. And Biden has, there are half a dozen, which I've had on my blog, half a dozen places where he says he wants to ban it. In my last presentation, I didn't have time to get to Hunter Biden and corruption, but that is another one that's just beyond belief. And incredibly, again, Chris Wallace did not ask Biden the question at the September 29 debate, but Trump did. And we had learned from a Senate report that Hunter Biden got a $3.5 million payment from the wife of the mayor of Moscow while Biden was the vice president. Do they do this for free? Do they just give away $3.5 million? And Trump says to Biden at the debate, the mayor of Moscow's wife gave your son $3.5 million. What did he do to deserve that? Biden did not respond substantively in any way. He says, that's not true. Then he said, none of that is true. Then he said, it's been discredited. Then he said, my son did nothing wrong. He had no substantive response. Okay. Those are the main points for me that a libertarian ought to be looking at, and I would urge you to vote for Trump.
This has been the Soho Forum Debate Podcast. Please go to Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to this and Reason's other podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening.